The U.S. withholds certain arms shipments from Israel.
Well, the reaction in general is, I would say, one of dismay.
Plus, students might be ready, but are colleges ready for graduation ceremonies following anti-war protests?
The university has been saying in a lot of the emails addressed to the students and the rest of the university community that the encampment and every other action that protesters were taking was the reason that they were threatening to cancel commencement, and the encampment has been cleared for a significant amount of time now.
And later, an update from Kyiv, and a look at Russians and Ukrainians living side by side in a remote Norwegian mining village. Plus, South Korea has a new government agency tasked with getting people to make more babies. Today is Thursday, May 8th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We visit the site of college protests in a few moments, but first, the top story continues to be the U.S.'s sharp escalation of pressure on Israel's war conduct. On Wednesday, the Biden administration said it has paused the shipment of weapons to Israel amid mounting concern about its plan to expand military operations in Rafah that the U.S. does not support. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara has the latest.
As casualties mounted in Gaza, the Biden administration warned in early April that U.S. support for Israel's war efforts would come with conditions unless it took concrete steps to protect civilians. With Israel launching its operation earlier this week in Rafah, in the southern part of Gaza, where 1.3 million civilians are sheltering, the U.S. warning came to fruition on Wednesday. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin.
We are currently reviewing some near-term security assistance shipments in the context of the unfolding events in Rafah.
It's the first time the U.S. leveraged a weapons transfer to influence Israel's war conduct since Hamas' October 7 terror attack. Human rights groups have long demanded the U.S. stop weapons transfers, accusing Israel of using them in violation of humanitarian law. The suspension was welcomed by progressives in Biden's Democratic Party, but criticized by Republican lawmakers, including Senator Lindsey Graham.
You want to micromanage the war? You know, we dropped two atomic bombs on the Japanese after Pearl Harbor. Did anybody in America really worry about that?
The U.S. first considered withholding arms last month as Israel seemed closer to a decision on Rafah, a senior administration official said. Because the Israelis did not fully address U.S. concerns, the administration decided to pause the arms transfer last week. Just a day earlier, President Joe Biden underscored his support for Israel.
And my commitment to the safety of the Jewish people, the security of Israel, and its right to exist as an independent Jewish state is ironclad, even when we disagree.
His administration recently approved $827 million worth of weapons to Israel. At the same time, it missed a Wednesday deadline to submit a report to Congress on whether Israel is violating humanitarian law while using American arms. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller.
We continue to work to finalize the report. We expect to deliver it in the very near future.
Even as Israel moves into Rafah, negotiations continue to end hostilities, along with the release of hostages held by Hamas in exchange for Palestinians detained in Israeli jails. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News, Washington.
John Kirby is the U.S. National Security Council spokesperson. He said on Thursday that it's too soon to know if the pause in weapons shipments has changed Israel's plans at all, and that Israel has to make its decisions, and the U.S. will react based on what they do. On the one hand, President Biden says the U.S. support for Israel is ironclad, while on the other hand, the U.S. is withholding those weapons shipments. For a look at how this mixed message is going over inside Israel, I'm joined by VOA reporter Ricky Rosen in Tel Aviv.
Well, the reaction in general is, I would say, one of dismay, because Israelis across the political spectrum don't like feeling like they're being dictated to. But Biden's show of support from the very beginning of the war and for months sending arms to Israel was recognized by everybody as essential to the war effort. And as expected, politicians on the right starting from Prime Minister Netanyahu, who repeated what he said on Holocaust Remembrance Day, that if Israel has to go it alone, Israel will go it alone, without mentioning Biden's threat to withhold the military aid. And then the far right members of his government, like National Security Minister Ben-Gvir, tweeted on X, Hamas loves Biden. And another member of his party compared Biden to Neville Chamberlain and appeasing Hitler's Germany in Peace in Our Time. And on the more centrist and left side of the political spectrum, opposition leader Lapid used this as a way to criticize Netanyahu for destroying the very supportive relationship that Israel has had with President Biden. And Ehud Barak, the former prime minister on the center left, also came out and said that the threat of a Rafah invasion is not worth destroying our relationship with the U.S. and destroying the chances of a ceasefire and hostage deal.
So it's understandable that Biden's holding back of some weapons for Israel's war effort, a war effort that many in Israel really see as existential. It's no surprise that elicits a lot of emotions. Are there similar emotions for the military action in Rafah? What is the Israeli public opinion on that?
It's reported that the majority of Israelis feel like a hostage deal is more important in the immediate future, like now, than a Rafah invasion, which would probably take a long time, be very difficult, and would further the isolation of Israel, both from its main ally, the United States, and European allies. And that's the majority opinion, but there's a strong minority who are demonstrating right now outside the cabinet meeting, saying with signs that say, Biden, stop saving Hamas, let us win. And especially because the hostage deal, which Hamas said they were accepting, the version that Israel had accepted, turns out to be quite different from the version that Israel had accepted. People are quite confused about whether to continue to wait for a hostage deal, whether to exert military pressure by, in fact, going into Rafah. But as I said, I think the majority supports holding back in favor of a hostage deal.
Ricky Rosen is in Tel Aviv. Ricky, thanks for your reporting today.
Thank you.
As the academic year draws to a close, graduation ceremonies are taking place at a more scaled-down level at colleges and universities across the U.S. due to pro-Palestinian student protests that have disrupted daily life. While some protests have achieved certain concessions, others have resulted in violent confrontations. VOA's Tina Trin explores whether mutually beneficial outcomes can emerge from recent events.
It's a disappointing end to the school year. After student protests over the war in Gaza led to violent confrontations with police, New York's Columbia University canceled its main commencement ceremony, opting instead to hold smaller celebrations at individual schools on campus. Alexis Ishmael is a senior at Barnard College, a school affiliated with Columbia.
I think we've all had a really hard last few weeks, and for it to end this way, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, too, like, we started online as freshmen, so in totality, it's really difficult to end this way.
Some are criticizing Columbia for making the move after clearing out a protest encampment. Oliver McCoy is a student at Columbia.
the university has been saying in a lot of the emails addressed to the students and the rest of the university community that the encampment and every other action that protesters were taking was the reason that they were threatening to cancel commencement, and the encampment has been cleared for a significant amount of time now.
As pro-Palestinian protests swept across U.S. campuses, some universities rushed to update their policies on free speech and protests. Zach Greenberg is an attorney at the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression.
I think this is definitely a wake-up call for universities that perhaps may not have had to enforce their protest policies to the extent that they had to do the last couple months.
Other U.S. college administrations have agreed to negotiate with students. At Rutgers University, this resulted in the school agreeing to add an Arab Cultural Center, as well as to other concessions, in exchange for the voluntary dismantling of the protesters' encampment.
This is obviously a very hot-button political issue, and I think students just want to be heard. So giving the students a seat at the table, allowing them to have a say in what happened, I think that's a great idea.
Many students have called for universities to divest from Israeli businesses whose interests are tied to the war in Gaza. Not an easy task, experts say. Mary Papazian is the executive vice president of the Association of Governing Boards of Universities and Colleges.
Divestment becomes more complicated simply because of the way that funds are invested. It's even spread as far as, you know, Apple and Google, who have business in that part of the Middle East. I think 90% of the S&P companies are involved in some kind of, you know, business. So how do you really break that out?
But student concerns shouldn't be dismissed either, she says. And universities should be transparent about their actions.
Sharing what we're doing and helping students and others understand what it is that we're doing, and most importantly, why we're doing what we're doing and why we're making the decision that we're making.
The University of Southern California has also canceled its commencement ceremony. At the University of Michigan, protesters briefly disrupted commencement services there. Student protests may have a storied history on college campuses, but it seems there are still lessons to be learned about how to handle demonstrations in a way that all sides can support. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Ukrainians and Russians living side by side in a remote mining village near the North Pole. We'll hear how that's going in a moment. Now, though, we get an update from Kyiv. Ukraine marks Europe Day as president of the European Parliament. Roberta Metsola made an unannounced visit to Kyiv, and the situation at the eastern front line continues to escalate. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details.
On May 9th, Ukraine celebrates Europe Day together with the rest of the countries of the region. Symbolically, on this day, the president of the European Parliament, Roberta Metsola, came to Kyiv on an unannounced visit. Metsola, together with President Zelensky, took part in the second annual International Summit of Cities and Regions. In his address to mark Europe Day, President Zelensky said that on this day, everyone celebrates the day of a united Europe based on law and cooperation. He added that now is as crucial time for Europe as it was when the modern project of a united and peaceful Europe was just beginning. Roberta Metsola noted that the EU has stood with the Ukrainians since the very beginning of the full-scale invasion and will continue to help in every possible way, condemn the aggressor, adopt sanctions against the Kremlin, and bring all those involved in war crimes to justice. She also expressed confidence in the European future of Ukraine. Meanwhile, the situation at the eastern front line is getting more intense as Russian forces continue to advance and break through to the city of Krasnohorivka in the Donetsk region. According to the official report from the Ukrainian armed forces, the Ukrainian army has currently blocked the assault groups of the Russian army that broke through to the city. Ukrainian troops report that the Russian forces do not stop trying to storm the city of Krasnohorivka with small assault groups. From time to time, isolated groups try to enter to eastern outskirts of town on armored vehicles. But most often they go on foot or in groups with motorcycles. The Ukrainian forces have so far partially managed to restrain the advance of the Russian forces deep into the city and its surroundings. Ukrainian soldiers managed to eliminate part of those groups that broke into a metal foundry in Krasnogorivka. Those who remained are currently cut off from the supply of ammunition and the support of armored vehicles. The fighting is ongoing. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
In Barentsburg, Norway, a coal mining town in the high Arctic, Ukrainian residents lived side by side with Russians. Since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, however, many Ukrainians have left the town after finding themselves in conflict with the Russian community. Henry Wilkins reports from Barentsburg.
Barentsburg, a coal mining town in the high Arctic. Here, Russian flags and Soviet-era throwbacks are common, like this bust of Lenin overlooking the harbour. But Barentsburg is not in Russia, it's in Norway. Barentsburg is situated in the Norwegian archipelago of Svalbard, more than 600 kilometres north of Norway's mainland. Because of the island grouping's unusual legal status, people from any nationality can settle here. Russians and Ukrainians historically made up most of Barentsburg's approximately 400 residents. But that changed in 2022 when many Ukrainians left. Katerina Shabratska is a Ukrainian who left Barentsburg before 2022, the year of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. She now lives in Longyearbyen, the major Norwegian settlement on Svalbard. Many Ukrainians moved to Longyearbyen from Barentsburg after the start of the full-scale war.
2022 changed everything. They didn't want to spend time there anymore.
Yes.
Because it was a lot of bomb for 2022.
Yes.
Yeah, and I feel it, and I knew it, so I also was like, "What the f***? I don't really to talk with the Russian people anymore."
Shabratska says tensions in Barentsburg started before 2022, and some Russians and Ukrainians had moved the year before. Norwegian locals say relations between the Norwegian and Russian settlements on the island were historically good, even during the Cold War. But that changed in 2022, when shared cultural events were stopped and business ties between Barentsburg and Longyearbyen were severed. Ronnie Brunvoll is a Longyearbyen resident.
Maybe because during the Cold War, it wasn't like a full-scale war with killings all over. Maybe that is part of it. What we see in Europe now is not what we saw through the Cold War, right? This is a full-scale bombing nightmare, which have really affected people here as well.
Katerina Shabratska says she and the rest of the community of 40 or so Ukrainians in Longyearbyen do what they can to raise money for the war effort back home.
Here we did dinners here, we did big concerts here, we did lunches here. That's how we work together.
Nearly a century ago, the Svalbard Treaty established Norway's sovereignty over these Arctic islands, made them open for all to live here visa-free, and prohibited military activity. There have been no open hostilities between members of the Russian and Ukrainian populations. But the war in Ukraine has created tensions, in some ways, resembling a Cold War here. And a new Iron Curtain has fallen between two communities that call Svalbard home. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Barentsburg, Norway.
We go from up near the North Pole to South Korea, where the president is hoping to turn his plummeting approval rating, as well as the country's plummeting birth rate, around. Reuters' Saikir Jasny has the story.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol admitted Thursday that his government's attempts to improve people's lives haven't been working out. In his first news conference for 21 months, he said that a crushing election defeat for his ruling party last month reflected how voters viewed his 2 years in office.
정부의 이런 정책과
There has been a lack of communication with the people to explain the government's policies and efforts.
Yoon, who narrowly won the presidency in 2022, now faces approval ratings as low as 21%. On Thursday, he promised new policies to revive the economy. He also vowed to tackle issues like the country's rock-bottom birth rate. Already the world's lowest, South Korea's fertility rate sank again last year, with women citing factors like the cost of childcare for not having kids.
I would like to share that we're establishing a new government agency to respond to the low birth rate and assigning it to work as a control tower. This low birth rate issue is not something we can take time with, as it is a national crisis.
Yoon also apologized for the first time over the controversy surrounding his wife's acceptance of an expensive gift in 2022, calling her behavior unwise. On foreign policy, he maintained South Korea's stance against supplying weapons to conflict zones, including to Ukraine. Despite being a major military exporter, South Korea avoids providing more than humanitarian aid to Ukraine to avoid upsetting Russia. Yoon said Moscow had been a good partner for the country.
That's Saikir Jasny of Reuters reporting for us. And finally today, human rights activists say political repression in Pakistan has increased in the year since supporters of former Prime Minister Imran Khan stormed military facilities to protest his arrest. VOA's Pakistan bureau chief Sara Zaman has the details.
On a recent April morning, Fahmida Farooq traveled for hours to come to the Supreme Court of Pakistan. Her son, Fahim Heather, has been in military custody for nearly a year. She says it has been terrible and she can't explain it. Only she and her family know what the year has been like. Heather is among more than 100 civilians tried in military courts since supporters of former Prime Minister Imran Khan stormed military properties in protest of his arrest on May 9. In October, a 5-judge bench of the top court halted the military trials of the accused civilians, saying the move was unconstitutional. The government quickly challenged that decision. In December, a 6-member bench of the Supreme Court allowed the military trials to resume. The legal flip-flop has frustrated families. Junaid Razak's son is also in military detention. Razak says he's surviving and going to courts with the feeling that the law and the constitution have become irrelevant in Pakistan. Haris Khaliq, Secretary General of the Independent Human Rights Commission of Pakistan, says military trials are just one example of increased repression in Pakistan since the violence last May.
So there is a reclaiming of political and decision-making space by the military as a consequence of May 9.
Former Premier Khan has been jailed since August, charged with crimes that he has denied. There's a de facto ban on saying his name in mainstream media. Freedom Network, a Pakistani media watchdog, says curbs on dissent have increased as a February ban on social media platform X continues and journalists are under investigation for allegedly maligning government officials. Khaliq says the revolution Khan supporters may have hoped for on May 9th never came, but the events of that day deeply impacted Pakistan.
Consequently, it has further fragmented Pakistani society. So there is a push for rule of law and for respecting the constitution. And so that is there. But otherwise, we are a very angry and a very tired lot.
State authorities have repeatedly called May 9, 2023 a dark day, promising punishment for perpetrators. The military said it took action against its own officers as well. Dozens of families are still fighting for an open trial for loved ones taken into military custody a year ago. Sara Zaman, VOA News, Lahore, Pakistan.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.